I had to go through a time to reconcile my faith with science. I did my degree in biochemistry. I think because I was continually confronted with design, just in my work, it was so hard not to believe. It was so hard to doubt God.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
Today, I'm happy to be joined by Rebecca Valerius. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Rebecca is a classical educator and author. She's earned a biological science degree in biochemistry and a master's in apologetics from Houston Christian University. Her academic interests include the works of G.K. Chesterton and philosophical and literary apologetics, and also the philosophy of science. She's an alumni of the Discovery Institute, and she teaches biology and advanced placement chemistry at a university model classical Christian school in Texas. And Rebecca, before we get into all the meaty stuff and discussions, tell us a little bit about your faith journey and you know, how you ended up where you were and how you became a Christian and maybe your family. I don't know anything about you.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So I'm in Texas, so born and raised in Texas most of my life. I was born into a believing family, very consistent church attenders, so raised in the church. So I could say there was a time as a child, I never did not believe. So my conversion happened very young. I grew up in the Baptist tradition. And I was baptized at age 7 by one of my uncles who was a Baptist minister, raised in the church. I will say my biggest faith struggles came my first struggle started when I was a teenager, but then I reconciled things in my 20s and really became very serious about my faith. And then it was afterward that I went through a period of doubt. So that's what got me into apologetics and why I ended up getting a degree in it, because I love it. I found a huge passion for it, and I saw how much it helped my own faith, my own journey deeper into the riches of what Christianity has to offer, both experientially and philosophically, intellectually. And I'm married to a believer. I met my husband in church.
Okay. Good place to meet him, rather than the bowling alley or the bar.
Yeah. It's a very great place to meet. And we met in our singles in a small house church. And our two daughters are believers. We have a daughter in college right now, and then another one that's a senior in high school. And I actually teach at the school that they went to. And so, yeah, that's kind of my story, I guess.
Cool. And outside of ministry and apologetics and writing and stuff, what do you enjoy doing? What recharges you, gives you a good perspective? What, do you have any hobbies or outlets?
I love to bake. So a few years ago, I got into sourdough baking. I don't know if it's as big in New Zealand.
My wife does it. We're gluten intolerant, so she's become good at it.
Anyway, that's one of the reasons why I started it. One of my daughters was struggling, and I was with some issues, digestive issues, and they suggested sourdough. And I have a background in biochemistry, and I started looking at it. I'm like, oh, I'm just creating a culture here, a yeast culture. I can do this. I do this in the lab all the time.
It's like an experiment.
I love that. Let's see. Well, I recently went back to, I teach, and I just noticed how talented my students are in drawing. And I teach science, and oftentimes I'm having to draw on the board, and I realize I really need to improve my stick figures.
Need to up my game.
So started to teach myself to draw, because, you know, you can learn anything on YouTube. So
yeah, oh yeah,
I love to do that. But really what I love to do to recharge is just a really good nap. I love taking.
Yeah.
Is that a hobby? No, no, no.
No, but it's a recharge.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. And so I wanted to ask you, in your bio, it talked about one of your interests is philosophical and literary apologetics. What can you unwrap that? What are, I'm an apologist. I don't even know what they are, really.
Yeah. So I often have to explain this because the program that I did my master's in apologetics in is at Houston Christian University. It was Houston Baptist University at the time that I went. And the program is called Cultural Apologetics. But a lot of the emphasis was on C.S. Lewis and his writings and Tolkien and Chesterton. Chesterton, not as much, but that's a big part of it. And looking at how they used culture and in particular literature, since they were both writers, to present in a more indirect way a defense for the faith. So that would be where the literary apologetics would come in. So it's sort of a creative way to do apologetics. And then the philosophical.
Would that be like that, like the C.S. Lewis hiding the gospel in the Chronicles?
Yes. But I understand so much that idea that, oh, well, that's all the stuff I learned in Sunday school. I know all that. And so it's basically taking the truths of Christianity and making them showing their beauty through literature. And there's multiple ways. You can do it through story. You can do it through poetry. We had a lot of artists in the program. You can do it through music, obviously, through art. I also have a background in ballet for many years. I trained in professional ballet. And so I love the arts and I love that aspect of the world. And then, of course, philosophical apologetics is just your standard stuff that, you know, you probably think of when you think of apologetics, William Lane Craig and yeah. And that was a huge, I love philosophical apologetics because as being trained in the sciences, I was pretty familiar. I had to confront, do the reconciling my science and my faith.
Yes.
A lot when I was doing my degree in biochemistry, but I was pretty weak in the philosophical aspects. I'd had some philosophy courses in college, but didn't really know like all the amazing arguments there are. And coming from philosophy, and really science itself is founded upon philosophy, right? You have to begin with philosophical assumptions. And so that's what the philosophical apologetics would be.
Makes sense. You're a rare bird there. You use all parts of your brain. You're artsy and all that, and you've got a science background. I used to teach high school biology. I'm pretty much just, was it left brain? Just linear and analytical. But I'm married to somebody who's fully right brain. So we balance each other out.
That's
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so on your bio also, before we get into some of the stuff, I think it'll be juicy. You mentioned that it's listed as you're the president of the Society for Women of Letters. That sounds intriguing. What is that?
Yeah. So about 4 or 5 years ago, several of us women got together and just realized that there was a gap and support for women in the Christian community that were either scholars working in a field, and that's where the letters come from. So they're scholars working in, whether it's theology, philosophy, any kind of the humane letters, and also women that were just scholarly minded. They love the life of the mind. They might not necessarily be scholars doing research somewhere, but they love things like apologetics. And there was a need to come around and support these women because oftentimes we felt like we were a bit isolated. It was hard to find other women like us. And so we decided to start this society where we could bring these two groups of women together, the women that are actually doing the scholarly work, and support them, and then connect them with these other women that would love to learn from them. And so create this sort of learning environment. And it's really morphed into something that's not just women. I mean, we've had men come on the show. We've had, if you've heard of Gavin Ortlund, and we've had Andrew Clavin. Those are some names that people in the area would know.
Are those speaking events or like book review, book club type thing?
Yeah. So we have these online meetings. We actually call them salons. And it's very confusing for people because they think a hair salon. No, the salon is actually rooted in some history that goes back to the 18th century. Women used to, when they would be, it was usually upper middle to upper class people would have these gatherings like dinners. The men would separate and go off and their cigars and their discussion in the
parlor
into another room, the parlor, right? Or the salon. And there was a group of women that started saying, let's invite the men here and hold these salons where the women can discuss these important things, because women, you know, it was sort of just sort of the culture that women were not supposed to talk about things like that. So that's what got the name from.
My wife and I are partway through watching the series, The Gilded Age. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's similar to Downton Abbey, but in New York and that in the American culture. And boy, was it snobbish. And boy, were the women patronized and put off in the parlor. And, you know, you can do knitting and social events and charities, but nothing of significance. So, well, good on you. And did you say you were the founder of that society?
No, I wasn't. Dr. Melissa Kane Travis was really the instigator of all of this. And so she has done work with Thinking Matters New Zealand. So she and I both, when we visited New Zealand, we had the great pleasure to visit your beautiful country last summer and fell in love with the country.
So did you get to tour around a bit, or was it just all work? You did. Awesome.
We worked, but we did have tour time, and it was amazing. Of course, we went to Hobbiton and did all of that, but we were on the Southern Island, I guess, and then the Northern Island. So, and then, of course, just getting to meet all the amazing people. It was just so encouraging. But yeah, one that really instigated it all and brought us women together. So she's the true founder, and she was the president for several years. She just recently stepped down so that she took on a full-time faculty position back at Houston Christian University. So yeah.
Cool. When you were in New Zealand, I missed your talks. I don't know what I was doing. I do a lot of kids camps, and that's pretty high on my totem pole of priorities. I might've been back in America doing fundraising. I don't know, but yeah, I know you talked about deconstruction, right? And you know, yeah. How did you become interested in that topic? And yeah, I mean, first of all, what is it? Some people might know what deconstructing things, you know, a salad, a taco, what?
Yeah.
Christian deconstruction.
It's a popular word you hear a lot now. But really, when I've looked at stories of people deconstructing, it's just the new sort of nomenclature for doubting. And I've been very interested in it because, like I mentioned, I got into Christian apologetics pretty passionately because of a season of really deep spiritual doubt that I went through. And
you were a teen, a mid-teen, late teen? Where were you?
No, actually, I was in my early 30s. And
okay. We
just had our really our first daughter. Our girls are 2 years apart. So it was right around the time when I just had our daughters, and they were very little. And I went through it's a complicated thing that caused all of it. But yeah, so because of that, I'm just very passionate about helping people work through doubt and teaching them what I went through and how I worked through it.
Was it more intellectually based? I mean, you got a hold of some atheists that flipped your wig a bit, or was it emotional? Something bad happened, somebody died? I mean, or a little bit of both.
Yeah, it was actually it's very interesting. It was actually a combination of things. And this is something I say in my talk that I did in New Zealand on doubt. You can break it up. You know, there's intellectual doubt, there's emotional doubt, and then there's maybe volitional doubt. I will say maybe when I went through a rebellious time in my teens and I wanted to fit in with people, that was more volitional. It was convenient to doubt, but mine was a kind of a combination of both. I think there was definitely some brain chemical things going on because, of course, when you just have babies, women, biology here, our fight or flight is on high. But our fight or flight is on high in high gear. And so it's easy to be very anxious about a lot of things. And when anxiety comes in, you start to kind of, and it's very natural when you're afraid and that fight or flight kicks in, you're going to hone in on the things that can cause danger, right? To the exclusion of other good things, right? And I think that's how my doubt was working. I was homing in on like all these questions that I had that I really didn't feel confident in, which was really weird. Now, I also think a big part of it
was that because your faith had never been challenged. You didn't research anything.
No, it had been challenged. So when I was in college, so in my college years, my late teens, early 20s, I had to go through a time to reconcile my faith with science. And I've believed I had done it pretty well. So I did my degree in biochemistry. And when I got out of biochemistry or out of my degree, I went into research. So I did 4 years of research in a lab doing protein structures. So doing X-ray crystallography and determining protein structure. And I think because I was continually confronted with design, just in my work, it was so hard not to believe. It was so hard to doubt God. It was when I left the lab and had children and I was out on my own that I wasn't confronted like that with that, like I had been before. We had also, I mentioned my husband and I had met in a small house church. It was an amazing church in a lot of ways, but it turned out that the pastor of that church was abusing women in the church. So there was also this sort of confidence issue.
Sure.
That I don't think was really driving me. I wasn't angry. It was just sort of makes you question everything you believed.
Yeah.
And
that's ironic, but I've been there where kind of an abusive cultist type situation and came out of that quite wounded. And my faith was just at an all-time low. And my wife was like, do you still believe? Yeah. Do you still believe in Jesus? Yeah. That he's the only way to God? Yeah. But that's about all I believe at the moment. And and to me, it was counterintuitive. But people have told me, no, that's really, you know, especially deep church hurts and spiritual hurts. Your whole faith system just is in jeopardy and crashing.
Yes. This particular pastor was an extremely talented and educated pastor as a teacher. And I had learned a lot from him. So I will say, you know, my growth in my, I grew up in a big church here in the Dallas area, Dallas Baptist Church, and it was wonderful in a lot of ways, but my biblical education did not keep up with my education, my secular education, okay. We could say. And when I entered that church, I had a lot of questions in my late teens. That's where I did a lot of the reconciling of my faith and science in that church, because I was finding the answers and I was finding some biblical depth that I didn't have before, as far as just biblical education. And so again, so to have it come out that he wasn't who he was. He was living this double life. It makes you question. It was interesting. I was just listening to a deconstruction story about from a singer, Christian singer-songwriter, Audrey Assad. And she was telling her story, which it was a number of things led to her deconstruction, but one of it was abuse. And she was actually abused herself. She was one of the victims.
Tarp.
So, it's a common thing. So I think that was a part of it. I also had, we had an acquaintance at the time that had walked away from the faith. He was trained as a scientist, was an MD, and he was pounding me with questions and doubts. But what about this? When he was bringing up all these supposed contradictions in the Bible. He was bringing a lot of the work of Bart Ehrman to me, if you're familiar with him. He's a very skeptical biblical scholar.
Yeah.
And I just, all of a sudden, I just felt overwhelmed with questions and doubts. And it just, there was a deadening effect. And I continued on. I mean, the thing that I tell people to do that I did, and I'm just grateful to God that I did, I let people know. I did not hide my doubt. I did not. I was thankful that I had my husband was extremely supportive. And I had some very dear friends in my life and a mentor, an older lady that had mentored me, that I felt comfortable sharing with them about my doubts and asking them to pray with me. And I kept going to church, even though sometimes it was very painful to be there because I felt empty, especially in the praise and worship. And So it was multiple things really that caused the doubt. And so in my talk, I try to.
Let me pause you for just a second. Don't mean to cut you off, but What that relational aspect, you had a mentor, you had people around you. How key a part does that play when somebody's faith is in jeopardy, you know? And
huge.
Just somebody that'll listen.
And I think that people want to isolate themselves because there is this idea that you failed somehow.
Sure.
Because
you're stigmatized. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're stigmatized that, and some people don't want to talk to you about it because I think some people are afraid as well. And one of the things I always say is doubt is actually in the Bible. I mean, Thomas doubted. John the Baptist doubted. He sent his disciples to Jesus, right? When he was imprisoned and he said, "Are you the one?" He baptized Jesus, right? He heard the voice from heaven. "This is my son," you know, and yet he found himself in a situation that was terrible and very stressful, and he doubts. So doubt is very natural. But a lot of people are afraid to admit, and so they isolate themselves.
Or what might can compound it a lot of times, if they're in any kind of leadership in the church, because they're supposed to have a ride, they're supposed to be leaders, they're not supposed to be doubting, and that compounds it, and they bury it until finally they haven't talked it through, and boom, it's, so-and-so's left the faith, so-and-so's deconstructed. It happened overnight. No, it didn't happen overnight.
No, it never does. It never does. I have a friend, actually the Sharps, who I believe have been to New Zealand, Roger and
Mary Jo and Roger, yeah.
He has a ministry to pastors that specifically for that reason.
Wow, brilliant.
Where pastors can reach out because it is a difficult for people in ministry who have people underneath.
Yeah, who can they confide in? Who can they talk to? Who can they, you know, it can be, it's lonely at the top, but it shouldn't be. It just cries out for relationship and community, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so that was your lifeline, one of your life, I guess, you know?
Yeah, there were multiple lifelines. And a huge thing for me too, is that I understood what I was doubting. And in the sense of, I knew what I would be leaving behind, and that it was it's the greatest story ever told. It's our salvation.
Yeah. Where else shall we go, Lord? What else do we have to do? You know, like the disciples.
But I kept saying to myself, "Help me in my unbelief. Where else have I to go?" So I relied on the scriptures. But I will say it didn't cure it overnight. Just saying that it took time.
Would have for sure. So, I don't know. What about, like, you've obviously gone through it. That makes you the perfect candidate to be help to those that are in the midst of it and whatnot. And it's good that you distinguish the different types of doubt, you know, your intellectual doubt and your emotional doubt and your volitional, just strong-willed teenagers and whatever. Is there a difference or a distinction between healthy questioning versus destructive and that which kind of leads to a loss of faith?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe absolutely. I mean, ultimately, it's the motives in our heart, and we have to have a humility. We have to kind of doubt the doubt, I often say, doubt ourselves doubting. So there's a certain type of a heart condition you have to have. I think there's healthy questioning. And I think pieces of advice that I give people, and it was very helpful for me, is, and this is coming from a scientist, so you'll understand this, is to classify the type of doubt I'm dealing with and classify it not only just intellectually, emotionally, volitionally, classify it in terms of how core is it? Is this a doubt that is so core about the person of our Lord and the person of Jesus and his work on the cross and his resurrection? Is this sort of, I call it, does it touch the Nicene Creed war of our faith, the heart of our faith?
If that was a peripheral item. Okay.
Yeah. Versus something on the periphery. That is like, and I've heard other people talk about theological triage. So, you know, when you have in a hospital, you have triage. So when people come into the ER, they have to decide how serious is this? And they put it in a first degree, second degree, third degree level. And if it's this thing where someone has they're having a heart attack, we need to get to them right away. Someone comes in and they have you know, just more milder symptoms of maybe a cold or something, but they have a fever or something, that would go on a level that's not demanding immediate care. So one of the things that's very helpful when you're dealing with doubt is to ask yourself, is this a doubt that's touching that core? And if it is, I need to take it very seriously. Or is this a question that's maybe about something maybe more on the periphery, like the age of the universe, right? And one thing I will say is periphery doesn't mean unimportant. It may be very important. I know a lot of younger people today, and the interview I was listening to from the Audrey Assad, she brought up the issue, some cultural issues, like cultural issues on homosexuality and the teachings in the church on that. Okay, well, is that a core issue? No, it's not. And it is periphery, but it's still very important, and it can relate back to your evidence in scripture and other things.
But how does that clash with you know, a kid coming out of high school or university where that your sexual identity is the core of everything? Do you have to deconstruct that?
Yeah, it's very hard. But then you have to go back to the person of Christ, and you have to go and reconcile your confidence in scripture, your confidence in the eyewitness's account, your confidence in, the full biblical account. And the amazing thing is we can do that. God has given us his word. He has preserved it. You can go and do the research on how the scripture has been preserved throughout the millennia. Yeah, there's people like Bart.
Is that what you had to go to? Well, you're getting back to Bart Ehrman. I mean, yeah, because the authority of the Word of God was in question, and that's a biggie. That's a core item.
That's
one of the tops.
That's where we learn about Jesus.
Right.
Those disciples. So I had to work through all of that. And I am so glad I did, because it strengthened my faith so much that anytime I do have doubts in other areas, I kind of can go right back to that. Those confidences that I built up then. So.
Yeah, very good, very good. And so when a young person is questioning, you just tell them, hey, is this a core issue? I mean, where do we rank this, and where is it coming from? That's good. I like it. And you walk the journey with them. You get to interact a whole lot with, you know, where you teach. You get to, because I used to teach biology at a public high school, and I help run the Christian club and stuff, but my real meaningful interactions was a bit limited there. Do you get to purposely interact and disciple the young people there?
I am so blessed to teach in the school that we do, and to teach science. And so I teach biology and then chemistry, advanced placement chemistry, which is basically college level chemistry to high schoolers. And I love it because I get to weave it in all the time. So one of my favorite apologetic arguments, and one that really was also an anchor for me, because I was actually struggling with atheism and, you know, can we know anything? And does evolution explain everything, right? Have scientists really kind of, you know, proven that, you know, this universe sort of created itself and all of that. And I started thinking, well, I mean, if evolution produced my brain, and evolution is a blind, mindless, purposeless process, what reason do I have to trust my brain? If my thoughts are only my brain, well, so are my doubts.
Sure.
Well, can I even trust my doubts? So I love to bring that in with my biology students when I teach them about neuroscience, and we talk about the brain, and we talk about how the neurons are just, you know, ion channels, yeah, right? Propagating a signal. Well, how does matter become consciousness? And so, yeah, I it's a blessing to get to weave all of that in. And that sometimes I have opportunities to speak at their chapels. And
how cool is that? I was reading, you know, a little bit of your material, trying to get a handle on who I was about to interview here. And it was something that I hadn't thought too deeply about, that what did you say? I realized in order to trust my doubts about God's existence, I had to presuppose my ability to reason. That's pretty cool.
I did. Yeah, to trust my doubts, I had to. And on under atheism, that presupposition is much more tenuous, right? It is a...
Sure, like, for what you just said.
And when I've talked to atheist friends about this, they say, yeah, well, it's just, we have to just take it on faith. No, I'm like, oh.
Oops. That's an option for me, but not you. Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, that's also another anchor for me anytime I begin to doubt, because I think just doubting is normal. I mean, anytime you have any kind of suffering, in recent years, my father died. He passed away from Parkinson's disease.
Oh, sorry to hear.
And it was hard. It was so hard. And I didn't understand why he was allowing it. And at times when things were really bad, I had to go back down to that core and back down to the core of who Jesus is and my confidence in him. And
I'm sure, you know, this will date the podcast, but, you know, we're right on the cusp of Charlie Kirk's assassination. And there'd be a lot of people just reeling. God, where are you? Why did you allow that? Thinking of 101 different scenarios in our small mind and limited thinking as to how it could have gone different, you know?
The problem of evil like that is often at the heart. And for me, when my girls were little, it was definitely that. And I was, you know, as a parent, you're worried about your children all the time, but especially when they're so little and they're so helpless. And it brought that home to me of like, oh my goodness, what have I done? I brought this child into this, you know, this very hard and difficult world. And, you know, yeah, then events like this happen and you have to always have to go back to that. It's always challenging to your faith.
It's yet another, it used to be atheist biggest go-to, you know, the problem of evil in the world and whatnot. And it's easy to have, you know, the evidential apologetics as far as science and biochemistry and whatnot. You know, you got your Dr. James tour, which just seems to just put the nails in the coffin for that kind of stuff. But then with the problem of evil, it's a whole nother area.
Well, and it is a problem. There's no, the only solution is the cross. And that was one thing that was really big for me, realizing, well, if I reject God based on the problem of evil, and this is classic apologetics, you have problems for things like morality and our reasoning faculty, right?
Yeah, sure.
And morality just really, truly does become a product of this blind, purposeless process of evolution. Right. And given a different evolutionary history, we might think something that we call bad now is good, right? Because it was just programmed into us by a blind, mindless process. So you have to give up so much. It's like you're hemmed in a way that if you walk away from the faith because of evil, you also kind of walk away from the ability to call something evil. And, but it still is a problem. And, our answer is Christ. And we can't say why did God allow Charlie Kirk to be shot when he did? We won't have the answer. We have to trust him. We have to trust what he doesn't tell us he was willing to enter into and suffer for us and enter into our humanity like he did and he has. And go through everything. We're told that he suffered everything. He knows all of our conditions. And so that's the answer that we have to rest in.
Yeah. And it doesn't help us at all on this earth a lot. But, you know, when you think about where him being in such a better place, you know, it's the old thing, would you rather come back to this earth? No, I'll stay here. They'll join me soon enough. You know, I could just imagine.
Paul says it. Paul says to be with Christ would be better by far, but as long as God wants me here in the flesh, I will be. And that is a deep truth.
Mm. Yeah. Do you come across many that would say that, well, apologetics and that kind of thinking is part of the problem. It's part of the reason that, you know, in other words, can I just be spiritual without all the objective truth, you know, hanging around? It's just a Western construct of this objective truth stuff. I mean, where do you go with that when somebody makes that claim?
Yeah, and that's actually growing. So there's a very interesting book that I reviewed probably about 5 years ago now for the Christian Research Journal that called Strange Rights, and it's written by a young woman who is a sociologist trained at Oxford. And I think actually in the process of writing the book, she came back to Christ after leaving the faith. Very interesting story. But she did a lot of research on what we call in America the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. They check nun on the box for religion, for religious surveys. And the atheists like Sam Harris and the old style atheists used to claim, see, look, you know, God belief is in retreat because of science, right? And when she actually looked at the beliefs of these nuns, they're actually very religious or spiritual.
Spiritual, right? Yeah.
And they kind of pick and choose. So they still want meaning in their life. So they won't have this godless world that's meaningless. But they want it on their own terms. It's very individualistic. It's very, like, I want...
A baggage of religion and all that entails.
Yeah. And I
organized religion.
A lot of it, they do reject organized religion. A lot of the organized religion that they reject, she found, is a lot of the sort of already deadened organized religion. So mainstream churches in America that have really lost the gospel or are just preaching kind of the self-helpism, you know, the therapeutic deism, I think it's often called. And they've rejected that, but they're also very much just sort of pick and choose, like a buffet, going through and picking what they'll believe and what they won't. And it's usually a God that's not going to demand so much from them morally. So that's not an uncommon thing. And it is hard to deal with. Sometimes young people.
And do you think that puts that in the category of the will? They're rejecting truth because of the volition? Okay. Want to do what I want? I want to construct a God in my own image?
In my own image. And, you know, I'm young and I'm not faced with my mortality like I will be. A lot of times they do come back to the faith when they get married and have children. It changes, right? They feel more vulnerable. So that vulnerability is not a bad thing. It can push you deeper into your faith. And so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so are there any topics or issues that tend to arise more? You're on the high school campus a bit with the questioning and the people going towards a deconstructive, you know, towards a deconstruction. Is there anything you see a general pattern of, or more than others? Issues like the LGBTQ issue or authority or abuse or, yeah.
I think that is a huge issue. And I do think the authority and the abuse issue is huge too as well. But I do think the LGBTQ thing is big, because what we have with that whole contingent is an alternate morality that's being set up. And you see that they are quite moral in their belief that they are right. And anyone that objects to their view that this is natural and this is good is evil. So they have a moral system where you can join and you can feel righteous, because we want to be good. You know, I think God created us to want to seek truth, even though, you know, we are original sin and we do distort it. There's something still inside of us that does care. And so young people do get drawn into that for that reason. And definitely abuses in the church. So many of these deconstructions that I've read about, there's some kind of abuse in their background in a church. And it's usually bad, like not just Christians disappoint me, because, you know, we're all going to, no church is perfect, especially the moment I join.
Exactly.
I think Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, a quote like that I just love of him. But
no. he was such a one of a kind, wasn't he, Chesterton? My wife and I were watching I don't know what it was on, but Father Brown Mysteries, and then we realized they're written by G.K. Chesterton. Like, ah, oh, that figures. Just what an intellect. Yeah, and one of the quotes I use for him all the time is, you know, before you go and tear a fence down, you know, ask yourself why it was put there in the first place.
That's a great question to talk with these kids about authority. So they look, and it's very, you know, it's very common. It just, even the whole idea that it's called deconstruction now, as if it's a better term, but it's just doubt. It's the same old doubt that I had 20, 25 years ago. But it, you know, when you're young, you think you know more, and there's a certain arrogance you have. So this idea that, you know, for 2,000 years in church history, you know, and beyond, you know, we have confined marriage to a man and a woman. Well, to them, well, that's just bigotry and we're right now. But the question that Chesterton is encouraging to ask is, well, why did they confine that to marriage? Why was sex, human sexuality put in this fenced in area? Another beautiful idea from Chesterton I love. You give me talking about Chesterton, I'll go on and on. I'm a fan. But he has the idea that you can build boundaries of something around something that actually ensure those things can grow and become bigger and not go past the boundaries, obviously. So it's like he calls it a fence built around a wide open field. And I have this image of like we're sheep often in the Bible. We're sheep a lot in the Bible. And we're in this field because there's a cliff. And there's a fence that keeps us from going off the cliff. And so maybe human sexuality was put in this institution of marriage, not just out of just some oppressive, you know, non-thinking thing. There was a royal reasoning behind it. And we know it's divine reasoning. It's divine design.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that fence analogy.
That's good. It's very applicable to a lot of different situations in life that we come across. Yeah. Yeah. So obviously in your case, in Sean McDowell's case, the questioning and the doubts can lead to a more robust faith. I mean, how alarmed would you be if your daughter came home? She's the one in university, or son, you know what I'm going to ask you. And they started questioning and doing that. How alarmed would you be?
I would, of course, a part of my heart would be worried, because she's a free will being. And, you know, how much is it volitional? How much is it? How much is this? But I would just be as supportive as I can with her. She knows that I can point her to a lot of material. And,
but the danger is that new spirituality that so many young people, they want to invent their own spirituality, don't they? And so the facts, they're immune to the facts in many cases, aren't they? Like they're water off a duck's back.
Yeah. Well, there's a huge, when you're young, there's a huge pressure to fit in. And you dream to fit in. And you want to be seen as good by your culture and by people. And by people you admire, maybe they're famous people or not. And so, of course, there's that aspect to it. And I've given my doubt talk to parents. I've tailored it to parents before. And I tell them at some point, you just have to be like Monica. So St. Augustine in the 4th century, when he wrote Confessions of, you know, famous Christian father, his mother prayed for him before he finally converted to Christ. She prayed for years for him. She was a faithful prayer, you know, praying for him. And so that's an aspect that we have to ultimately do. And we have to, as parents, this God, she is yours. And this is her journey to you. She stands before you alone, not with me. When children go out to make their faith their own, it is scary in this
place. It is. I mean, my daughter, she's 36. She's over in Melbourne now, and she's charting her own path, shall we say that? And it's tough for me as an apologist, as a, you know, having done all this, what I thought was the best I could do raising her. And my wife is like you. She's not, you know, not too nervous. God's got her in her hand and everything. But me, I'm like, oh, you know, it's tough. It's easy to say, but it's tougher to live, you know?
Yeah, it really is. It is. At that point, you just have to trust the Lord and say, she's yours. And I will keep praying.
Yeah.
And I will keep being as long as she allows you in her life, you can say things in the loving way. You know, sometimes parents are the last people that can say something true with the kids when they're in this. So, yeah, it's hard. It's hard. But I also do, I love, and I believe it's in Lord of the Rings. Very appropriate bring up being on in New Zealand there. But there's a point at which Frodo turns to Gandalf and he says, I wish this ring hadn't come to me. And Frodo says, you know, we can't decide, I won't quote it correctly, but we don't decide the time in which things like this happen. And basically, we don't decide when we're born, and we don't decide the situation that's going to be challenging to our faith going on in the world. And so I do have a confidence that the Lord does decide when we're born, and He knows. And so, you know, we do our best to equip our children and to support them, but we have to trust Him with what He's doing in their lives. And
yeah.
And never give up praying.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's all we can do at this stage. I mean, we do have a great relationship and stuff, and but just she is where she is at the time. Yeah. Well, so I want to get back because, you know, I was a science major and a chem minor and whatnot. And so what were some of the difficulties you had to overcome, you know, with your chemistry? Because certainly you got a healthy dose of evolutionary theory there and genetics and stuff like that. What were some of the things you had to iron out with that? And maybe you're still wrestling with some. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's very interesting to me that it was really in my biology classes that I had more of my adamant atheist professors that were
very— They represent the highest portion, don't they, of the scientific community we identify as atheists.
Yeah, and the chemistry, my degree was mainly in the chemistry department, so I was a bit shielded from that. But my biochemistry professor was, and he was wonderful. I loved him.
Uh-huh.
A British guy. But he was the one in that department that was pretty, he would sometimes just spend class just raking over creationists, right? And he lumped anyone that tried to reconcile faith and science as a creationist, and they were all the same. And I'll never forget Michael Behe, if you know who he is, his Darwin's Black Box had come out a few years before, and a campus organization of Christian faculty members had brought him on campus, and he came and gave a talk. And I will never forget, my biochemistry professor was a tall guy, over 6 feet. He was sitting behind me, and I could just hear him throughout the whole talk from Michael Behe, just kind of wrestling. At the Q&A, of course, he tried to just tear him down.
Yeah.
And at the time, Michael Behe just responded with such graciousness and patience. And of course, his talk was wonderful. It was a huge influence on me and just understanding some of the problems with random mutation and natural selection being able to account for all the complexity of something like the bacteria flagellum. And but more than anything, it was just his demeanor of just patience and kindness with him that just really struck me as a young student.
Those are the apologists that really resonate with people, Christian and not, you know?
Yes, he's amazing. This past summer, I just got to meet him in person for the first time, and it was so amazing to get to tell him that. Like, it was such an encouragement. So that was cute, your standard reconciling. And I actually get to teach my students origins, and I love it, because what I focus on is materialistic naturalism, philosophical naturalism, as how does it really explain the scientific evidence we have? And the evidences I put forward are the evidence of the beginning of the universe, the evidence of complex designed life, the origin of life, the origin of human consciousness, the origin of morality. Atheistic naturalism, ultimately, all those things become illusions. Even the origin of the universe, either the universe can create itself, right?
From nothing. For no reason, yeah. Nothing,
or we have this multiverse, which just pushes the ball down the road a little bit. You still have to explain it. And I focus in on that because I realize at our school, we have students that probably come from a multitude of Christian perspectives, whether it's young Earth, old Earth, old universe, young Earth. You know, there's all these different...
A lot of nuances, yeah.
And I don't tell them where I stand on it. I say, you know, this is something you get to go home and discuss with your parents. But I just want you to know that even if, like, say you're in the young Earth creationist camp and you start doubting, that doesn't mean you have to abandon your faith completely and I'm a naturalist. Because look at all the problems over here in naturalism's camp. And that, to me, I wish I had been taught that way. I hadn't been. I've been taught very exclusively young earth creationists, although my father himself was a mathematician, a PhD mathematician, and he was always very quiet about it. And I think he sort of compartmentalized things. But at church, you know, it was definitely learned from the young earth creationist perspective. And when I started having doubts in that, I had to reconcile that. And where I stand now is, I don't know. I definitely see intelligent design. And I think that's one of our greatest.
I love the work of Stephen Myers, you know, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt.
I have a collection of books I was going to hold up to you, but his Return of the God Hypothesis.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah. It is. He's one of my heroes. I'd like to interview him too. I don't know if I'd get to, but yeah, just I find his argument so cogent and so compelling, you know, and I've heard him do some debates, but I haven't heard anybody, you know, really get to the core of what his thesis is. I really haven't. And he's debated some top dogs, the Shapiros and other people, you know, Dave Shapiro and what. So, yeah. And you were part of the Discovery Institute. So you know him, I assume?
Well, no, I'm not part of, I got to do, they have an alumni program, or they have a program where you get to come out and study with them over the summer. And I got to do that, and we got to meet. Well, he actually wasn't there. He had to Zoom, and he was in England. But I got to meet Michael Behe and a lot of the other leaders in the intelligent design movement. And that was just amazing for me, because I had known them since a young student in biochemistry and had always loved their work and had followed it for years. So it, yeah. So that's, that was a big thing I had to reconcile when I was younger, and definitely.
Cool. Well, so currently, you know, we unless you live under a rock and you don't do anything, there'll always be an argument or an atheist or whatever that gives you pause and thinks, okay, we do need to consider that. Is there any such atheist or atheistic argument that right now you're wrestling with or think has some merit or whatever?
No.
Really?
To be honest, I when I was really struggling with doubt, I doubted everything. I really, when you talk about deconstruction, I did it. I doubted everything. I thought I had reconciled the science and faith issue. And all of a sudden, I was revisiting it. And of course, I was looking at the deeper philosophical issues, which was, you know, very, very helpful. But no, I really don't. It's not to say I won't. I think if there's one thing that does get me, it's the problem of evil. And I just don't think there's no easy answer.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Are there any, Rebecca, as we're kind of starting to land the plane, are there any questions or topics that you like discussing that you wished I'd have brought up, you thought I might or whatever, regarding deconstruction or anything else?
And I love to talk about G.K. Chesterton.
I can tell by your website and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually just published with the Christian Research Journal an article on Chesterton's Orthodoxy. So it's a book I recommend everyone read. It is probably next to The Everlasting Man. Those two books are his most important apologetic works. Orthodoxy was written in 1908, but it's amazing how prescient and how still relevant what he was arguing was then. And that's something I bring up in my paper. There's a lot of talk, and I don't know if you hear it where you guys are in New Zealand, about re-enchantment. So disenchantment and re-enchantment. So we live in a disenchanted world that's been disenchanted through basically materialistic naturalism. That, you know, all meaning and purpose have been removed. And so there's this move to re-enchant the world. And of course, this is part of what the nuns are doing. They are, you know, they had everything under the sun. I mean, we have witches, we have spiritism coming back, and with a vengeance in some ways. It's a bit disturbing. But how does Christianity answer this problem of being able to approach the world rationally and understand it like science? I mean, science itself is based on some deeply, deeply fundamental Christian assumptions. And actually, in fact, you remove those assumptions, then science itself is on shaky ground.
Sure.
So you want to approach the world rationally, but you also don't want to strip the world of meaning and purpose in the process. And so Christianity kind of threads that needle perfectly. And Chesterton talks about that in Orthodoxy. Yeah, I could talk about him for hours because he is a huge influence on me. And I think he should be read more. He's hard to read. Because
I find Lewis kind of hard to read. People talk about, you know, Lewis's, some of his works and Mere Christianity. I picked it up at least three times. I just get frustrated. I can't get through it.
I recommend people to do because Orthodoxy is that way as well. So Chesterton's Orthodoxy. And part of it is their prose. Their prose is much bigger and larger than our prose. We moderns like to get to the point and get there quickly, you know. And they sort of seem to beat around the bush. One thing that's really helped me, and I know it's helped other people, is as you read along in a print version, listen to an audio version. And you can kind of get a little bit more feel for the rhythm of the writing. And that helps. But yeah, just keep at it. It's so worth it when you do.
I'm sure. Out of all the things you do, I mean, you write, you're a mother and a wife, and you speak and do conferences. What floats your boat? What do you really enjoy? What's your favorite thing out of all the stuff you do? Do you have a favorite?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. I do love to write, but I also hate it. So I love having written something, but the writing process is very hard because writing is thinking and you're trying to. So I love to write and I would love to be able to write more. I do love teaching though. Teaching is exhausting, as you know, but it is so incredibly meaningful. And I'd love especially to be able to teach science in a way that is not divorced from our faith and show how it's so dependent on belief in God. So I think that's been a huge delight. That's something I want to retire doing.
Really? That's cool. Yeah. I read a book a while back, Teaching That Changes Lives. It was about Howard Hendricks and Dallas Theological, how much he was well loved and stuff. And I thought, if I had it to do over again, I would have certainly been more, what do you say? You teach students, not topics. I'm like, sometimes I could get so locked into the topic. And so it is realizing there's people sitting there.
Well, and it's tiring. So, you know, when I got my degree in 2019, I got my master's in apologetics. And I remember telling the Lord, okay, here I am, use me. I want to write. I had taught science before and I just don't want to teach. And I said that.
Yeah, that's up to the Lord what you want to do.
Because then the doors just opened up at our school and they needed someone. Mm. And I stepped in and then I realized I love this. It's incredibly hard, but incredibly meaningful in that sense, because you do get to, sometimes it's hard. I mean, they're teenagers. I'm teaching high school and they don't want to be there sometimes.
Right. Yeah. That was the frustration about being a high school science teacher. They had to take it. And some of them made it very apparent they did not want to be there.
They did not want to be there. They do the bare minimum. We're a bit blessed because we're at a kind of a special school. It's a classical Christian school. The people that are there tend to be much more motivated. There's a lot more family support. So that helps, but you still have to deal. That's the hard part, but it's still wonderful. I enjoy it.
Yeah, but exhausting at the end of the day, you know? Definitely so. Yeah. And one of the things I ask all the podcasts that I do, what is it that kind of waters your soul the most as a Christian? Keeps you from getting stale and routinized and just lifeless? What spiritual practice or discipline do you do?
Oh my goodness. I think it's a number of them. And it really depends on the season. Definitely scripture, reading scripture, staying rooted in scripture, but prayer. I tend to struggle a bit with prayer. And so I found different ways around that, like writing my prayer. I actually have a Word document with my prayers in it. And I have I set it up every month and I read through that. But that waters my soul, but definitely fellowship. We have a good church and I have just, God's blessed me with a lot of wonderful people. And both our my husband and I's life that we can just fellowship with and fellowship around the Lord and around what his work, around what he's doing. Apologetics does it for me. I kind of view it as a spiritual discipline, as educational, right? The feeding the mind. So I would say it's multiple things, and it depends on the season too. When things are harder, sometimes all you can do is prayer when you're just exhausted. Yeah. And even that's hard. And
yeah, you've said, you're the second apologist that have openly admitted that they're it's hard to pray. I find it hard to pray. I find it like, I say, it's kind of like talking to this chair. There's a chair over here. Some people say, oh, God told me this and spoke this. And when I was speaking to the Lord, he said, well, that must be fantastic. I've never experienced that.
I haven't either. And I have known dear people in my life that do. And I'm so for them, but I just don't have that. And maybe that's just something in what has happened in our lives. It hasn't, I don't know.
Could be. I mean, God talks to my wife when she's in the shower or on the toilet. And I'm like, oh, come on, I'm agonizing here. I'm trying to strain to hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's, go ahead.
But I think he can speak through studying apologetics. I mean, it was so interesting. We're in a reading group right now, my husband and I, early morning, Friday mornings, and we're reading through Augustine's Confessions. And I've read through it several times, but I was just astounded by the first book that he breaks it up in book, and he's going through his life in it. And already in just like the first chapter, he's mentioned just in passing quite a few apologetic arguments. You have a moral argument. You have an argument from design in there. You have several contingency arguments. So I'm thinking, but he just mentions it in passing. But it's just beautiful. And that to me, that is praise when I study apologetics. That's when I feel a closeness with God, more so than when I pray. So, I think it's different for different people.
Yeah, it surely is. Surely is. Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us and just sharing your heart and sharing your knowledge and just hopefully being a blessing to whoever might listen to this. And listen, if you're out there and you want to know more about her work and dive deeper into her writings and whatnot, let me make sure I can list them all. The Christian Research Journal there, an unexpected journal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perennial Gin and Worldview Bulletin there. And you have a Substack, your own Substack. Is that most of the places they can find you?
Yeah.
If they want?
Yes. Oh, and may I just plug really quickly one more very amazing website just about doubts that I meant to do earlier. Talkaboutdoubts.com. Talkaboutdoubts.com.
Okay.
Yeah, I recently became a part of it. It's founded by a Discovery Institute fellow, Dr. Jonathan McClatchy. And it is a wonderful ministry where you can fill out a form and someone will contact you and they'll connect you with an expert, an apologist in the field that you can doubt some questions with. And I've got to sit in on a couple of these with young people that are doubting.
Oh. And they do an audio call, video call, or just chat when people get around to it?
A Zoom call. And if it's with, it's always two people. If it's like a young person, especially if they're under 18, there's always going to be two, it'll be a female and a male there. And I don't know, it's just an amazing ministry for people that are doubting. And it can be anonymous. You can just send in your questions that way too. And if you go and look at their website, there's a lot of the apologists you'll recognize,
Yeah. And you've added to those conversations or resources? Yeah.
I've gotten to be a part of a couple of them, and it's just been a blessing. I was thinking, I wish this was around when I was struggling.
That is so cool, because you have a lot of people that have a little bit of time in their hand. They would love to help somebody struggle with doubt, but they might be stuck at home, stuck in their books. But somebody reaching out to them, connecting them, that is just brilliant.
And it's
talkaboutdoubt.com, you say.
Talkaboutdoubts.com. And it is, we've talked to people in Singapore and in America. And I mean, it's amazing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. You're a wealth of resource and knowledge and vulnerability. We appreciate that. Now, make sure you tune in, those of you, to the Future Thinking Matters podcast, where we'll explore faith and reason and hear some very interesting people like we have today. So until next time.
Tune in next time. God bless you.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.